Come, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. And he who has no money, come, buy and eat. Come, buy wine and milk without money and without price. Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which does not satisfy? Listen diligently to me, and eat what is good, and delight yourselves in rich food. Incline your ear, and come to me, hear, that your soul may live. And I will make with you an everlasting covenant, my steadfast, sure love for David. Behold, I made him a witness to the peoples, a leader and commander for the peoples. Behold, you shall call a nation that you do not know, and a nation that you did not know, you shall return, shall run to you because of the Lord your God and of the Holy One of Israel, for he has glorified you. Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let him return to the Lord, that he may have compassion on him, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. For as the rain and the snow come down from heaven and do not return there, but water the earth, making it bring forth and sprout, giving seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goes from my mouth. It shall not return to me empty, but it shall accomplish that which I purpose, and shall succeed in the things for which I send it. For you shall go out in joy and be led forth in peace. The mountains and the hills before you shall break forth into singing, and the trees of the field shall clap their hands. Instead of the thorn shall come up the cypress. Instead of the briar shall come up the myrtle, and it shall make a name for the Lord, an everlasting sign that shall not be cut off.
One of the most important tenets of Bible-believing Christianity is that we believe in personal conversion. In fact, it's our goal that if you have not been personally converted to Christ, that you would do so. Now, if you're a secular person here today or an unbeliever, that might make you cringe. That's what people hate about Christians. I can remember when Ann and I were going to Chile way back in 1993. I had taught at Western State College of Colorado for 5 years. And I was friends with the husband of one of my colleagues in the music department. We were friendly with one another. But he was clearly anti-Christian. So I was in the gym one day. This is near the end of our time there. We were getting ready to move, and we were going to move all the way to Chile. And he came up to me, and he said to me, "You're not going to go down there and try to convert people, are you?" And then he went on this long diatribe about missionaries taking their religious beliefs and their culture, and which he sort of mixed all together, and that people shouldn't be forced away from their own personal or cultural beliefs. Maybe you feel that way. Since 1993, that sentiment has only grown. That's a huge sentiment. But here's the thing about that. And with all due respect, if you feel that way, you have actually been converted to your way of thinking. So by being vocal, my friend, the geology professor, was trying to convert me, right? What's the difference? There's as much evangelism in that ideology as there is in our ideology, maybe more on that side. Everybody's trying to convert everybody to their own way of thinking because your way of thinking is what you think is right. And so you want to convert everybody to your way of thinking. So I'm overtly saying the goal of Christianity is for people to see the beauty of this. The beauty, see, the proof is in the ideology. What does it offer? What does it promise? Does it fit the narrative of life as we know it? So I'm a Christian because I believe that Christianity makes more sense out of the world than any other system. Unashamedly, I'm a Christian for that reason. It makes more sense. So today's passage gives us what I think is the essence of Christianity. And you decide. So I want us to look at three things from this passage, and there's so many more that we could look at, but three things here. Number one is the invitation to a feast. Number two, the reason for the feast. And number three, the joy of the feast, okay? An invitation to a feast. Number two, the reason for the feast. And number three, the joy of the feast. So the first one, the invitation to a feast. So there's an invitation to a feast. At verse 1, come everyone who thirsts, come to the waters, and he who has no money, come, buy, and eat. So the invitation is for anyone who thirsts, but it's also for those who want to eat. And so the implication of this is that there are people who are hungry and are thirsty, right? And I don't think it's talking about physical hunger or physical thirst. The implication is that people are not satisfied, that there's a hole in the soul, that there's something that makes us restless, that makes us not be completely at ease, at peace, at rest. There's a hole in our soul. And every ideology has a recipe for how to fill that hole. Here's one from the musical group ABBA. You may know this song. It's called A Hole in Your Soul. It says, you feel bad? Let me tell you, we all get the blues. Sometimes life is a burden way down in your shoes. When it's bad, worse, worst, and when you're feeling so bad and you think you're cursed and you've got it sad, well, if there's one thing for the better that you can turn that can turn you loose, it's got to be rock and roll to fill the hole in your soul. That's it. That's the key. It's rock and roll that will fill the hole in your soul. Or perhaps you might look at the song by that band and group of theologians called Aerosmith, entitled Hole in My Soul. And this was written by Steven Tyler, and he's talking about a one-night stand, and this is what he says. There's a hole in my soul that's been killing me forever. It's a place where a garden never grows. There's a hole in my soul, yeah, I should have known better, because your love's like a thorn without a rose. How about that? There's a pickup line for you, because your love is like a thorn without a rose. Take that one to the bank, guys. So will rock and roll fill your soul? Well, it might for an instant. It might feel like it, because there's some pretty cool stuff out there, I think. But what happens when the music stops? Well, then you need more music to fill the soul, or clearly a one-night stand isn't going to fill the hole in your soul. I wouldn't say anybody would say it would, but I would go further than that. Not even a loving, committed, lifelong marriage will fill the hole in your soul. Your spouse will always disappoint you at some level. Music won't fill the hole in your soul. Oh, I know musicians who pursue it and pursue it and pursue it. I've had overwhelming experiences in music where I've just felt total joy, but then the music stops and then you need more. It never lasts. You always need another performance. The arts will bring spice to life, but they'll never fill a hole in your soul. Your children, your family, your money, your job, busyness, nothing will ever fill the hole in your soul because it's been shown to never be enough. You get something and you need it again, or you need a little bit more. That's the strong thing about addiction. You get it, you need more, you need more, you need more, and pretty soon you're in trouble. And so the prophet Isaiah asked this question in verse 2, why do you spend your money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which does not satisfy? So there's an invitation to a feast, and then he asks, why in the world would you spend your money when we're offering this feast for free over here? Why would you spend your money on that which does not satisfy, and yet we do all the time? But there's an offer here, right? So here's the first verse again. Come, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters, and he who has no money, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without price. And then at the end of verse 2, listen diligently to me and eat what is good and delight yourselves in rich food. So the offer here is satisfaction. It's what he's offering. And it's completely free. It costs no money. It is a free invitation to satisfaction. Come and have your soul's hole filled. So what is it that will satisfy? Well, number two, the reason for the feast. So the reason that we need the feast is because we are all too prone to satisfy our thirsts at poisonous wells. Wells that only lead to disaster. In Christianity Today, there's an article entitled, Fame is a Fake Version of Friendship. Russell Moore says this, unlike Macaulay Culkin, who starred in the famous Christmas Home Alone, movie Home Alone, his younger brother Kieran turned down multiple opportunities to be a child star. Now, he was a child star as well, but he struggled in this way. He learned by observation that he didn't want a life of fame. He didn't want a life of fame, knowing it could lead to things like substance abuse, court guardianship battles, and the like. We might be tempted to view the life choices of famous people like the Culkin brothers from a distance, but maybe we're looking into a collective mirror. Today, fame is not just something that happens to stars, child, or otherwise. Thanks to the age of social media, many of us are turning into mini stars, with the only real difference being the size of our audience. The leaked Facebook files, which discuss the inner workings of the social media company, include data about the harm Instagram usage inflicts on the self-image of adolescents. Every child or teen faces a fear of judgment from their peers. They also fear being exiled from their social group. However, the world of social media seems to heighten these dynamics, where almost everyone is followed by a kind of paparazzi exposing and subjecting us to the approval or disapproval of our peers, acquaintances, and often complete strangers. Philosopher Alain de Botton writes, the subconscious argument goes, if I'm famous, I will be free from facing any rejection or judgment. I will have an instant and safe community. However, he says, the exact opposite is true. Fame makes people more, not less, vulnerable because it throws them open to unlimited judgment. What are you looking for to satisfy the hole in your soul? What do you do to satisfy the restlessness that is contained within? So what our passage is telling us this morning is that we need to turn from these things. We need to turn from these things. Look at verse 7. It says this, let the wicked forsake his way and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let the wicked forsake his way and the unrighteous man his thoughts. What we have here is two parallel phrases with two words that are synonymous. The wicked and the unrighteous are used as synonyms. Now, they seem like very, very strong words, and nobody wants to think of themselves as wicked. But I promise you, he's not name-calling. These are not pejorative terms. They're not terms to make people to call names at anyone. So we know that wicked, the word rasha in Hebrew, means evil, immoral, or highly offensive. And then we get some nuance with that, with the word unrighteous. Besides meaning evil, it adds the words injustice, deception, or false. So what this is trying to show with really strong language is that any place that you drink to satisfy the thirst in your soul any place else other than the one that is inviting us, any place else is a disaster, will end in disaster. That's why the strong language. That's why it says wicked and unrighteous. It's actually a warning. It's a warning that we need to take heed of. So what's the answer? Well, it says in verse 6, seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let him return to the Lord that he may have compassion on him and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. So who is the Lord here? I don't have time to develop this, as I said. Verses 3 to 5, the Lord, we can conclude that it's Jesus because he is the seed. He is the product of God's faithful love for David. The point here is that we're to seek after Jesus while he may be found, and he will provide satisfaction for our souls. Now, I saw a really cool thing in here. This is actually in the book Gentle and Lowly. A lot of you have read that book, I think. And this is astounding. It says he'll provide satisfaction for our souls. How? It says that he's compassionate and he will abundantly pardon. And by the way, Dane Ortlund stole it from Calvin, so, you know, I'll give it there. He gives him, he quotes him, but the idea comes from John Calvin. So the point is the invitation to the banquet. And the invitation is to come to Jesus, the only one who can satiate our hunger and our thirst. How does he do that? How does he satiate hunger and thirst? What is the invitation? What is he saying? Come and drink. Come and eat free. What is he offering to us? What is it that's going to satiate our souls? Well, he offers forgiveness. For our God, he will have compassion on us and he will abundantly pardon. So not long before she died in 1988, Marguerite Lasky, who was a poet, a playwright, a novelist, lived in England, and one who contributed some 250,000 words to the Oxford Dictionary. That's astounding. 250,000 words to the Oxford Dictionary. She was also one of our best secular humanists and novelists, and this is what she said. What I envy most about you Christians is your forgiveness. I have nobody to forgive me. Such a learned person. Drinking at the well of academia, drinking at the well of intelligence, of erudition, drinking at this well, and she comes to the end of her life and she says, I have nobody to forgive me. This is why there's a hole in the soul. Everybody knows that something's not right. Why am I so anxious? Why am I so frustrated and angry? Why do I lie awake at night because I can't turn my brain off? Why am I downright afraid? Because there's this sense that everything's up to me. That I have to solve the problems of the world. That I have to get this right, or doom is awaiting me, or maybe it's the guilt of wrongdoing. There's all these things, but it's about me. But no matter what that might be, it's the wrong path. He's not saying that wickedness is these isolated acts of disobedience. That's what everybody else would say. You're wicked. Oh, he did that, and he did that, or they did that, or she did that. See, it's not, that's not what it's talking about here. Although that might be included in it. That might be the results of it. But what he's saying is that wickedness is following our own path, being the masters of our own fate, finding truth in ourselves, doing what we think is right, looking inside of ourselves for guidance, carrying the weight of the world on our shoulders. And this has been preached from every corner of our society. You can do it. You decide. You be your authentic self. And people are falling apart. It's not standing up to the scrutiny. There's a hole in our soul. We were never meant to do that. We don't have the strength and the ability. And so the call of the passage is to turn from self-reliance and turn to Jesus and trust him. And by the way, that's the biblical definition of repentance. It's I'm going one way, and I turn around and I go the other way. What's the other way? I pull myself up by my bootstraps and I do better. I quit doing this bad thing that I'm doing, and now I go and do it better. I quit doing it. I'm going to live my life correctly. Is that what that is? No. No, 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 no. It's I quit looking at myself, and I turn my eyes to Jesus, the one who has compassion on me, the one who says that he will abundantly pardon. I quit following my own path, my own definitions, my own formula for life, and now I follow Jesus because he's the one that fills the hole in my soul and he's worth following. But this is the thing I want to show you from, sorry, I got ahead of myself. This is what I want to show you from Calvin. Does he really forgive, and how abundantly does he forgive? How abundantly does he pardon? And that's what these verses 8 and 9 are about. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Some people think, and I used it in my prayer that way, that he's transcended and we're not, and so he's far above us and we can't think his thoughts. We don't know that, but it's not really talking about that. It's talking about how he forgives. And what it's saying is, God is not like us. When someone does us wrong, we usually respond in like manner. When circumstances don't go well, we blame God or we think ill of him or we blame others. We constantly blame shift. We carry bitterness. We're anxious. We struggle to forgive. We struggle with compassion. We struggle with so many things, but God is not like that. His ways are not like our ways. How far different are they? Well, they're as far as the heavens are above the earth. That's how far. God does not respond tit for tat. The people that have not followed his ways and have sought to fill the hole in their soul in every other thing, he not only has compassion on them, but he will abundantly pardon. This is his disposition, and it's not just to pardon, but to do it abundantly. He's the lavisher of pardon. The pour out grace until you're overwhelmed. The bowl you over and knock you down with mercy and kindness and compassion and absolute forgiveness. His ways are not our ways. How is that? How do I know that? Because he himself came. He came into a dark world of people that were not following him. And he shone light in the darkness, and they took him and they crucified him. They put him on a cross, and he said, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. You want to talk about compassion? His ways are not our ways. I wouldn't have done that. This is our Christ. That's what the banquet's about. That's why we seek him. Number three. The joy of the feast. So why wouldn't we want to see people converted to that? Wouldn't you want to be converted to that? That's a life of joy. No one offers forgiveness like that. And no one offers a future like those who turn to Jesus. He offers, the Bible's full of it, of what the future actually looks like. So before we see that, see the verses that it has here, we have to understand that the earth was subjected to a curse. Because of the fall of man, of Adam and Eve, there was a curse placed on the world. And the Apostle Paul tells us about the curse on the world But then he alludes to what's coming. This is Romans 8:19. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. You see, this is what Isaiah is predicting here in these verses that I'm about to read for you. The creation will be let go from its bondage. That includes us. Our bodies will be let go. Look at what it says in verses 12 and 13. For you shall go out in joy and be led forth in peace. The mountains and the hills before you shall break forth into singing, and all the trees of the field shall clap their hands. Instead of the thorn shall come up the cypress. Instead of the briar shall come up the myrtle, and it shall make a name for the Lord, an everlasting sign that shall not be cut off. There's this great story in Luke chapter 19 where Jesus, it's called a triumphal entry. It's where Jesus rides in on a donkey. And the people are crying out, blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. And they're waving palm branches. And the Pharisees tell Jesus, rebuke them. Rebuke them. They can't be doing this. And what's Jesus' response? He says, I tell you, if these were silent, the very stones would cry out. The very stones would cry out. They'd cry out, glory. Blessed is he who comes. See, I don't think it's far-fetched to say that when the creation is released from its bondage to corruption, that the mountains and the hills will be so excited that they will burst forth into singing. No more will they be repressed, and the trees will clap their hands. Now, can you imagine what this will mean for us? We'll join the throng at the marriage supper of the Lamb, where Jesus will host the feast, and we will come without money, without cost, because Jesus already paid the price. He's paid it all. All sin will be gone. All sadness will be gone. All tears wiped away. Joy and peace will pervade every crack and nook and cranny. The heavenly choir will sing, and we will feast like we've never feasted before. And we'll be given new bodies, physical bodies, that will live on a physical new earth, but an earth that has no danger, no wars, no evil, no curse, where Isaiah 11 tells us that the lion will lie down with the lamb. Whew. That's a lot of stuff. You know what's interesting? Do you realize that Christianity is the only religion that believes that the earth will actually be released from its bondage? So secular people believe that the earth will eventually burn itself up, and that'll be the end of it. Eastern religions believe that the earth will fade away as you reach higher levels of consciousness because the physical is not important. Other religions believe that after you die, you go to heaven and you live in a paradise in heaven. But it's Christianity that teaches that the earth will be reconstituted. The curse will be lifted. Our bodies will be reconstituted. No more aging or dying. No more pills that I take every morning and every night to keep this thing going. No more exercise. Oh, well, maybe, but it'll be fun. It'll be fun. There'll be perfection, and the trees will clap their hands, and the mountains will break forth with singing. But I want you to realize this one thing, this last thing. Do you realize that the Lord of the feast, the Lord Jesus Christ, will be the only one there with an imperfect body? He'll be the only one there with wounds in his hands and wounds in his feet and wound on his side as a testimony throughout eternity that he gave his life for us, and we will worship him. Brothers and sisters, who doesn't want to be converted to that? There's no love like that, why would we continue to pursue all these things that don't satisfy? See, Jesus is the satisfaction that we need. See, that's the gospel. And if it's true, and it is, it really does change everything. Let's pray.